It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 499 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week has a very special interview. So special, in fact, that I'm going to go straight to the interview. There's a lot to get to in this episode's interview, so let's get on with the show. Okay, before we get started, I've got to explain a little something here. I had a serious dental surgery not that terribly long ago, and what that did was that meant, as far as teeth go, I'm lacking in that area. And so certain letters like S and F and things like that, they sound weird when I say them. They told me I'd sound like Donald Duck, and they're pretty much right. But the show must go on, and we've got some really good things and lots of interviews coming up. So I just wanted to let you know, if I sound strange, don't hold it against the guests, because they've got good products that we need to support. And the first one we're going to get to talk with is Tom Pinchuk from Zoop.gg, and he's got a wonderful book called Remember Andy Xenon. And how you doing, Tom?
Great. Thanks for having me.
It's good to talk with you, and I've already supported your book, and as we're recording a little early before this posts on Sunday, but the interesting thing about it is you seem to be about two-thirds of the way there, and So it's 20 days when we're recording this, and as I was telling you, I'm so terrible at math, I can't look at a calendar and go, 20 days, what is that? I think it's going to be right around September the 8th, but don't wait until that time. Go to zoop.gg/c/rememberandyxenon with an X. And go there and be sure to support like I have. And it's such an interesting book. So let me read real quickly a description, and then we'll get into some more of it. It says, he was a boy adventurer until he lost his powers and had to grow up real fast. Now Andy wants an answer. What went wrong? It's also described as a one-shot, 48-page comic. And I like these one-shots and stuff. And from my understanding, when I was looking up I listened to the video you have there, and I was looking up stuff you've done. You've been involved with younger heroes like Ben 10 and things like that, which I have always watched and I've always enjoyed. So I'm just kind of curious. Talk to me about this, because this seems to be, you know, I've always wondered, you know, superheroes and stuff like that tend to be people who are younger. And, you know, when they get to be when they start to mature, things start to go wrong. And apparently that's what some of what might be going on here. And I'm just guessing right now. You haven't told me anything about what the story is. But I'm fascinated that instead of seeing Andy Xenon at the beginning, we're actually coming in after things have gone awry, shall we say. So is this kind of, because I, you know, Star Trek, he actually wrote a show called, Gene Roddenberry wrote a show called Gene Roddenberry's Andromeda, which is like a post-Federation show. Is that kind of what this is? Are you kind of looking like what happens after Andy has his powers?
Absolutely. And by the way, thank you so much for supporting the book. I really appreciate that. I'd worked on characters like Ben 10 and Max Steel, and the artist that I'm working with, Nikos Koutsis, had worked on a reboot of Stretch Armstrong. And you know, these are kid heroes, kid adventurers. The thing that I was especially struck by when I came to work on them was that they were really awesome characters to write for, but they weren't iconic for me the way they were to a generation of young adults that I encountered when I was working on the shows. And the iterations that I worked on were these reboots where the characters had aged, and there was a certain generation of viewers who liked the fact that it seemed that they were growing up alongside Ben or alongside Max. And then, you know, the networks, the brands or what have you, have this crossroads that they reach where, okay, this is a kid show. It's supposed to be appealing to kids. The further away we get from these characters being 10 or in their young teens, is that relatable anymore? Especially if we're trying to target the next generation of kids who are going to be interested in the characters of the toys. So they had the reboots, and it was interesting because I would run into working professionals actually in animation and in comics who would talk about all of these fans. They feel so entitled, or they need to get a grip. And then when I mentioned I worked on these series, they're like, "Oh, now your episode's great, but let me tell you about this reboot." And I could see the frustration that you have a pretty concrete reminder that you've aged out of something, and you can stick around with it, but it's not going to be it's not targeted specifically at you anymore. And the kernel of the idea that I got was, well, what would happen, or how would it feel for one of these kid adventurers to age out?
Mm-hmm. See, it's fascinating. I find that so fascinating because, what's interesting, like, let's take Ben 10 as an example. I watched the various incarnation of Ben 10. He was a kid, and then he became older, and then he became another older, and they would change the name of the show. And finally, he was like a teenager. And yeah. Then that kind of came to an end. I mean, his sister started dating Kevin 11, which I remember looking at and going,
yeah,
not that.
Dating your enemy. Yeah.
Yeah. I that whole thing got me. But anyway, and now of course they've brought him back. He's gone back to being a young kid again. And I'm waiting for the next iteration to come along again and do that. But it's kind of interesting to me to look at this because, there's X-Men, and the mutants get their powers when they mature, shall we say.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to me that you've gone a different direction with this. Andy, and of course I don't expect you to spoil anything here, but Andy has basically come across an existence that is tough because he's gone the other way. I mean, yeah. Superman didn't start to get his powers until he was a teenager, although in early books that was not the case. He was Super Baby and Superboy and all that stuff. But the thing about it that interests me is this is going to be so interesting because I don't think I've ever seen a story that went this way. So I'm completely fascinated as to how you're going to handle it.
Well, what I like to tell everybody is that the end is only the beginning. So whatever I've described or we've gone over for the premise of the show the book is probably only the first third of the story. And there's a lot of twists and turns after that and maybe some unexpected chances or new purposes for Andy. I don't want to say too much about that. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely something that it's surprisingly that there's a lot more intrigue after the adventures end. Mm-hmm. And something that it's interesting because I was on another podcast and they brought up the sort of inversion of the X-Men. I just found it was a really useful metaphor because I think there's a lot of interpretation of the X-Men as being a model, mutants as being sort of a metaphor for puberty, right? Like I think they get it about when they're around 13 and, reading into that, or say like Spider-Man as well. But what I thought was interesting about this on the other end was it's an interesting metaphor for the ups and downs of life, right? Like you might think that you look back on your childhood and you feel it's been misspent, or your adolescence was reckless. And if only I knew then what I know now, I would have, been more successful and cherished what I had better. And it's something that, and what's been really cool is that the more the book has gone out there, I've been finding, people from a real wide variety of walks of life have found a lot to relate in the premise. Like I've talked with people who've been child actors and they find a lot to relate in it. High school athletes or college athletes who eventually had to, hang their gear up and, join the regular world. And I think it's something that it was a really great, it's just really ripe for drama, is that he's facing this identity crisis of, well, this whole time all these years I've been an adventurer and I've been living very carefree. And now I have a real, I've lost my powers suddenly and inexplicably, and I just have to make do, and I have to get a job, and I have to get a apartment, and I have to figure out how I'm getting groceries, and, have to learn how to relate to people, which is something that I even talked with some friends who were homeschooled, and they talked about that being an interesting kind of curve for them, because they would have, you know, part of the process of being, or, you know, part of the, I guess, the use of being in a public school or high school is just to learn how to relate to people your age. And sometimes if you're homeschooled, you don't really get those lessons. And so it can be sort of awkward when it comes like later in life, is that you're 18 and you're sort of, you know, learning how to socialize like you might have when you were 12. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't something that I strictly planned when I made the book, but I found it was interesting that was an interpretation I agreed with. So it's, you know, and in the same way that I think the X-Men has a whole variety of interpretations. I mean, that's what's great about metaphor in superheroes, is that you can find a lot of analogies to it. I think Andy's situation, like I said, whatever you're coming in with, you might find more to relate to Andy's situation than you'd expect.
Mm-hmm. It fascinates me, because that was what I was exactly thinking about, was child actors.
Mm.
You know, suddenly they are the center of attention. Everywhere you go, everybody runs up and wants your autograph. And then all of a sudden, you start to change as a result of age. And suddenly you go out in public and everybody's not running up to you wanting your autograph. And that is a major change for them, because they want to be, they're used to being the center of attention, and now suddenly they're not. It reminds me a little bit, I had a friend that I was growing up with, and he was a big athlete. He was, it took like all the rest of the kids in the neighborhood to be able to tackle him. He was so strong.
Yeah.
He got to college, and his knees started to give him trouble. And he ended up becoming a coach rather than a player. He wanted to go be a pro football player, and he ended up being a coach in like a high school or something. And he was never quite the same after that. It was, you know, now he's on the sideline telling other people how to be what he wanted to be. And so he was always very different. I think that's, you're going the same route. And that's why I'm going to be this whole thing fascinates me. I'm just dying to see what is going to be Andy's, you know, how is he going to respond to this?
Well, the other thing I should mention too, is we have a companion piece that's included in the book. It's a, it's like a in-world, like a faux magazine article that's a retrospective on Andy's lost adventures.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely inspired by like the biography excerpts in Watchmen. And I thought it'd be interesting to ground this in a little more sense of time and place and, realism. But you know, there's also interviews with other adventurers who were, contemporaries of Andy during his career, and they have varying opinions on him. Some of them liked him, some of them really didn't. Some of them wish, he were still around. Some of them are glad he's gone. Mm-hmm. They all have different theories about what happened to him. And then also we give, with each interview, there's a little bit of an exploration of their backstories that kind of explores that, you know, reckless youth angle, from a different, perspectives,
mm-hmm.
You know, and there was one in particular where he has, a potential mentor who's effectively telling him to, you know, make sure you kind of stop and, slow down and try to understand how you got here, because if you don't, someone could take it away. Mm-hmm. And then in the article, you find out why he's giving that advice. And it's because he had been on a team, like a family team. And there was this tragedy where it was a team of adventurers and the parents died. And then they didn't give enough instructions to the kids about how to maintenance their gear. So they could only be adventurers for as long as their gear doesn't break. And there's seven of them, and each one approaches it in a different way. Some of them quit right away. Some of them try until the stuff breaks. Some of them get themselves killed. And then this character is the only one who figures out a way to keep at it and keep in the scene. And that was actually inspired. I had been doing a lot of research, and I was really struck by the story of that, you know, that 80s band, the Jets. That was like this family of musicians. And it was kind of an interesting, like, at least the way that they told it was they could play, but they couldn't write songs. So they didn't have publishing rights. And they also had sort of been discovered by this retired manager who was like his last project. And what they were sort of ruefully remembering was that they would be going into these recording sessions or going to these record labels and not thinking that they had to make friends with staff there. Because you're a kid and you're being brought around, and your conception of how the business works and what your role in it is very skewed. And what they observed was it was kind of a succession of events where they got dropped by the label, and it was also while the manager was retiring. And what they found out really quickly was that because they hadn't made those contacts, it didn't matter if they had a hit record, they couldn't get back into that recording studio or that record label.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and it's stuff like that, that you don't, I even in my own experiences, I had a public access show when I was in high school. It was like the last days of public access, pretty much. And I was glad that, you know, I just sort of did it on a lark, and I really wanted to have some fun with it. And I didn't know, you know, it's interesting that the further I get into, TV since then, I have more perspective on what, how that show fit into like cable deals, for instance. Like, mm-hmm. we were really only getting that deal, or we could have that show because I think it was some federal ruling, or it might have been state ruling, that if a cable station had so many subscribers, they had to offer a community access channel, and then if they got bigger, they had to offer three. And so there was just a lot of stuff that I, you know, now that I knew like how those old logistics worked, I was thinking like, well, maybe I could have done even better back then, but it's too late. Right.
Mm-hmm. What was the show about?
It was just a really stupid kids sketch comedy show. It was just me and my friends. Mm-hmm. We would just do sketch comedy, basically. I mean, I was 14 at the time, and mm-hmm. I was more or less, I sort of had to wear all the hats, because I think that's, you know, the thing I always like think about when I see like that documentary about the kids who did like their shot by shot remake of Indiana Jones, or they, you know, they met friends who were really committed to the same vision. And it's like, at least in my experience, it was more like, okay, I want to do the show. The friends just want to appear in it. I have to be the one who's figuring out the directing, the writing, the editing, the setups and so on, because they're not going to, they're not that passionate about it. It was all, you know, pretty much every sketch was mine. There were occasionally sometimes there, you know, some of the friends would have ideas. Although I think even back then I was a little more conscious of like, let's maybe not, do some stuff that could get us into trouble. Like Jackass was really big back then, and I had to keep resisting that they wanted us to do these like dangerous stunts or pranks. And I was like, we're not doing that. Like, I'm not, like, you watch Jackass and you don't realize that has a whole army of lawyers behind it that is working for clearances and so on. So, you know, I mean, it's also funny too, because I do have those, that was all shot on Hi-8, and then we were edited on a dub deck with VHS. I still have the tape somewhere, but I don't really ever want to watch them, because I'm sure I thought it was a lot more clever back then than it is now.
Well, but it was a start. You got to start somewhere. It's like when I started this podcast, I was fascinated by interviewing and comics, of course. And I always had questions, and I could never get the answers to my questions. So I started out doing it, and I was part of another podcast that a guy was doing from the UK. And so I would do a comics section, and we would talk about comics, and I would do interviews and stuff like that. And I was just fascinated by the whole thing about how do you put this whole thing together. And so I invested in software, I invested in machinery, you know, the microphones and stuff like that. And I used to use Skype quite a bit to be able to call people, because once you sign up for Skype, it's free to call anywhere in the world. And I just started to do it. And if you ever listen to my very first episode, it's me talking for about 20 minutes, and it's horrible. It's just the world's worst 20 minutes if ever was. And I swore to myself, I was just doing that to get it up so that somebody was up there. You know, I could get started. And then I decided I was never going to do that again. I was going to always talk to people more interesting than I am. And that's what happens with this. That's why I'm hitting about 500 episodes before too long. But it's to me.
We're, we're coming up on the milestone episode 500, aren't we?
Yeah. It's 10 years. I hit 10 years in January, but I thought, I'm going to wait until I hit 500 before I do something special. We'll see. And of course, then my mouth happened to me, and now I'm not sure how I'm going to handle that, but we'll see how that goes. But the thing that was interesting to me, like you, I wanted to learn the aspects of it. How do you do this? How do you make this stuff happen? And what's funny is to me, the most fun parts are the parts that go in about 5 minutes. The picking of music, the stuff like that, the scheduling of people and stuff like that. I love that stuff. I used to spend a lot of time interviewing and also editing those interviews. I would spend 3 to 4 hours on every 20-minute interview editing it to get it sound well. And then people told me, what are you doing that for? People don't want to hear that. They want to hear it, the raw feed, as they called it. I said, really?
Right.
And so now I hardly interview at all. I hardly edit. I hardly edit.
I was going to say, what is this now?
Well, see, I'll do one other quick thing and then we'll get off of the subject. But I also don't believe in interviewing. I believe in a conversation. You and I are talking, and somebody is sitting there listening as if they were sitting in the room listening to us talking. It's almost like they could participate if they would. But to me, I always kind of feel like I had a friend of mine who used to write 10 questions, and it didn't matter what you said. And honestly, he didn't listen to what you said. He would go down that list of 10 questions. When you stopped, he would ask the next question. And of course, since he wasn't listening, he didn't know they'd already answered that question. I have to say, they answered that question. So I want it to be something interesting where it's fun and it feels very organic in how we do it. You know, I think that is so much more interesting. And I was watching David Letterman. He's got a show on now. And I was curious to watch how he handled the interview. You know, it was very much the same way as the way that I like it. It was organic. It was, well, what happened about this? When you bring the subject up, what does that mean? And, you know, I like things like that. Anyway, more than you ever want to know about that, but that's kind of the way I approach all these things. But the one thing I'm still interested in is what was it that caused you to write Remember Andy Zenon? Was there an event that happened? Was there something you've wanted to do this subject for a while and you finally got to it? How did you come to set this whole book up?
It was a lot of things. I worked the multimedia writer career, and it's just you can't always put your attention at every area at the same time. So I'd been working in animation for the past few years. I'd started in comics, but my attention had been more focused on animation, and I'd sold an original series actually to Cartoon Network that was in development for a few years. And we were, you know, we're plotting out the show and we're trying to see, okay, well, what's this, we're planning it out as if it's a given, it's going to run for multiple seasons. And then it was a casualty of the Warner Brothers merger. Mm. And it's just, all of this buildup and then nothing you can do with it. You have these characters that you want to introduce to a world and you can't do anything with them. You can't show them to anybody. And so that overlapped a bit with the pandemic, and I think there was a lot more time at home and sort of the same kind of soul searching I think a lot of people were going through. And I was thinking about, I really want to get back to basics. I want to tell a story to an audience. I don't want to have as many middlemen or having to have executive boards in between. And I'd also thought, well, what were some of the comics that had inspired me when I really started getting interested in how comics were made and what they offered as a medium? And what I noticed was that more often than not, they were self-contained one-shots, or nearly so. So The Death of Captain Marvel, Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow, The Killing Joke. You know, the one-off issues of Astro City were some of my favorites, and I really liked that sort of poetic focus. Also, I think that when you work on a kid's show, there's a lot that just by nature you have to leave on the table, because I think with every premise, you know, there's more adult concerns that you can bring into it or interpretations, but it doesn't fit for the show. I don't think it would be wise to deal with, like, you know, an identity crisis or existential ennui that someone might experience in their 20s in a kid's show. That would be a real failure of efforts, really. Mm-hmm. But what I loved about a lot of things in comics was that they had been able to take archetypes and do deeper explorations of them. And so and I thought about those interactions that I'd had with fans, and it started to coalesce. And the other thing that I thought was kind of fun was realizing that a lot of the shows I'd worked on were sort of part of the same lineage of superheroes, but mm-hmm. they were definitely their own beasts in a way, mm-hmm. because, you know, if you think about it, right, like the Avengers and the Justice League and so on and so forth. I mean, these are characters that were introduced in the Golden Age of superheroes and the Silver Age of superheroes. And there are certain trappings that are always going to be there. Like, you know, Superman dresses like a circus strongman because that was something that you were more likely to see back in the 30s or the 40s. Whereas if you look at Ben, he wears cargo pants and mm-hmm. a more like athletic shirt. It's still branded. He still looks like a superhero. He's got that, that alien watch. Mm-hmm. Max Steel was wearing almost like a frogman outfit that had more texture and practicality to it. You know, there were a lot of, I think a few other things where, for instance, like when we were working on Ben, there was a note in the Bible that, you know, the story Bible for the series that secret identities were going to be a non-issue. Mm. So no one, when Ben transforms into an alien, no one bats an eye. Nobody recognizes him when he's going on vacation, even though he never wears a mask. And I think that there was a brilliance to that because that simplifies the wish fulfillment of that premise, but it does intentionally leave a question off the table. And so in this comic, what I wanted to explore was, well, the secret identity is a huge issue for Andy because he wants to be recognized, or he doesn't want to be recognized by certain people. And he starts to realize that people are forgetting who he was. Mm-hmm. And so it was exciting to, in the same way that, say, you know, Miracle Man had found maybe more mature possibilities in, you know, the story of Shazam, or the way that, you know, Astro City was doing that for Silver Age characters, or I also found out about, there was a novelist, Philip Jose Farmer, who was doing these biographies of Tarzan and Doc Savage, because those were characters that he'd grown up on and he wanted to make them more grounded in realism. And I thought, well, what if it's exciting that I might be the first one to do it for this generation of characters?
Wow.
These types of heroes, Well, you know, I mean, look, in another life, I used to run like an anime magazine. And what I started to realize after a while was, I think every adventure fiction novel kind of has its eras. It's sort of like, like the eight stages of man in psychology, right? Where there's like the initial earnest phase, and then things get a little more mature. Then there's the deconstructionist phase, and then there's the reconstructionist phase. And when I was, reviewing all these anime shows, I noticed that there was a show called Madoka Magica that was was a more adult version of Sailor Moon. It was picking apart Sailor Moon. There was a series called Kashern Sins that was trying to find like really dramatic reads on this kind of disco era robot fighter named Kashern. You know, there was even ones that took the characters like Power Rangers and were trying to find more. I think there was one called like Samurai Flamenco that was trying to find a more adult take on Super Sentai, which is what, you know, Power Rangers started as. So I think it's a natural evolution. I think it's something that it's very cyclical with different traditions of superheroes and adventure fiction. I was also struck by, at one point, I remember I was really crowing about Madoka Magica to a friend who was an artist in Artist Alley at some Comic-Con, and he really couldn't wrap his head around that. He's like, why would anybody ever want to watch that? And I was like, well, I mean, look, man, we're 30 to 40 years after Dark Knight Returns. Like, this is an entire cottage industry of taking characters that started regarded as kid stuff and finding more mature takes on them. I don't think it should be that hard to imagine. Mm-hmm. So, that was the thought was I had, to tie it all back, when I ran into these fans of the shows that I'd worked on, was that look, I can empathize. When I was younger, I mean, there was, I'd grown up on, say, like the Ninja Turtles or Power Rangers, and there was a time when there were reboots that reminded me that I aged out of them. And, you know, you flash forward 10, 20 years, and this is, you know, that's what this new fan base is going through, and I could relate to that. And so I thought it was more constructive to take that, like, capture that sort of specific emotion and explore it in a story like this.
Mm-hmm. Because I can't remember where I was, but somebody was a Ben 10, one of the creators, and somebody was a kid went up and says, "What's Ben doing now?" And the creator looked at him and you know, rather than, and I he told him that he was still fighting hero, fighting, you know, villains and stuff like that. And I said to him, "Well, okay, I'm not a kid. What is Ben doing now?" And he said, "You know," and he gave me a very different answer.
Yeah.
Than he did, you know, for the kid. And I thought that was kind of interesting to see.
Well, yeah, that makes me think of I was having a pitch meeting with Disney once, and I was asking the executive, because she said that she'd actually worked on the staff, like at the Disneyland park,
mm-hmm.
Previously. And she said that she was like the handler for Goofy's son, who was mm-hmm. his character called Max. And he was introduced mm-hmm. in a show called The Goof Troop. And now I can understand, well, they have Goofy having a son. And of course, it raises the question of, like, well, who's Max's mother?
Mm-hmm.
And they never once addressed that in the show. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, I understand now that the reason they did that is because they were doing the development of the show, and they wanted to make a series that was relatable to single parent households, but they didn't mm-hmm. want to get into the really depressing concepts of like death or divorce. So they just mm-hmm. left it unanswered. But the thing was interesting was that she told me when she'd be taking Max around the park, kids would always ask that, and they'd say, mm-hmm. "Well, where's Max's mother?"
Mm-hmm.
And she would just say, "Oh, Max's mother is working. The reason you don't see her in the show is just because she's always working." You know, I guess she's just a real workaholic, which I suppose could be its own, you know, that's got its own kind of dramatic possibilities in itself. But I love that answer, because it was just that was such a great, like, sort of, it's just like you said, it's kind of like the child logic, right? Oh, mm-hmm. that makes sense.
Yeah, because I have to say that whole premise of the single dad business, that was so touching. I used to watch those.
Mm.
And I would always be really touched by those. I thought that those were really nicely done. I mean, it was tender, you know. Here's Goofy, you know, who is Goofy, you know, and who is, you know, terrible, awful. He's not what we would say respected by people around him, and sure. yet he still has tremendous love for his son, and it comes through. And I always kind of felt like, gosh, you know. That's actually a very smartly written thing to do that kind of stuff. And so, like, it's like with your book, I'm going to be fascinated to see where you go as far as directions for Andy, and for what kind of things. Knowing you, you're very likely to be able to go in, make certain things happen that we haven't seen before. At least that's what I kind of expect. And I hope so, because I'd like to see something different and something new, because I've been reading comics for decades. And for me to see something I haven't seen before, I go, "Oh, wow, I haven't seen that before." I'm always ecstatic. So this, with this one, I'm really going to be fascinated, because like I said, this concept is just something really good, because I have not, you know, it's like, what's Ben 10 doing now, you know, kind of stuff. What's right. Andy doing now? That you're going to get a chance to go to that place, which I have never seen anybody to my satisfaction answer. So I'm really going to be, I'm so looking forward to seeing that. I'm going to be fascinated to see what you're going to do with it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the hope. I think what I love about comics as well goes back to what I was saying, is that, you know, if you're working in TV, you have to have a lot of people sign off on it. And it kind of becomes a question of how many cooks are you putting in the kitchen. And in this case, it's like I had an idea that was maybe a little left field. I think it makes perfect sense, but it mm-hmm. hasn't been done before. And mm-hmm. that's something that's more exciting to me than, you know, the upteenth retelling of a origin story. Mm-hmm. I think also we really tried to keep the focus as tight and the pacing as tight. So there's going to be a lot more you know, unexpected directions with where the premise goes. And I think that they'll really fit. We've also, and I think the companion piece is something that I'm very excited for people to read, because those who have, what I really wanted to do with it is there, you can read the first story just on its own and be totally satisfied. But then if you read the next companion piece, then what it does is it provides a little more background on the characters that you've encountered, and then also maybe reframes and recontextualizes certain scenes. So when you go back over it and reread it again, you say, oh, wow, I now see a different dimension of the scene. I think maybe in the same way that what we talked about before, where it's like, you know, it's like kids' logic versus adult logic. And there's, you know, people who've had a chance to review it ahead of time have really responded to that. And that's something that's very, you know, gratifying for me, because that was what we aimed for. Because I think more than anything, what I wanted to do with this was make something that would have a longer shelf life, and also something that people could really, it's not just a show that you're binging, and then as soon as it's off, you know, it's off screen, then it's, you know, you're moving on to the next thing, and it's in one ear out the other. I really wanted to craft a story here that people could sink into and find more layers of meaning in, and notice some details and get rewarded for rereading it, that you start to notice certain details you didn't notice the first time, and something that is going to last a little longer versus, say, an extended prologue. Because I think that's a pitfall a lot of comics will run into, is that they really get carried away with the world building and the setup, and they don't tell you a story with a beginning, middle, and end. So it would definitely be easy, very easy, to tell more stories with Andy and with the other people in his world. But I wanted to go in and treat this, like, really take the notion of one shot to heart in all of its implications. So it's we treated it as like, this is our one shot. Mm-hmm. If we only, you know, we're not saving the good stuff for issue 5. We're just, we're giving it all to you in 48 pages. And it's something that we, you know, we're getting the most important stuff, the most emotional moments in the story.
So his mom is not working full time somewhere, then, I take it.
Well, we did actually have a comment in it about how he's an orphan, and that there's a little bit of meta commentary, but we talk a little bit about how, you know, there's a lot of tropes of adventure fiction that it's kind of comparable, where there's like a practical use, but it winds up getting reframed in a more like storytelling capacity. So, for instance, like the reason why Peter Parker and Harry Potter and Bruce Wayne and Superman, depending on which iteration of him you're reading, are orphans, is because that sort of frees them to, they're not as constricted the way, you know, kids with parents would be, or somebody with parents would be. So that's something we explore a bit. I mean, I guess we never really do touch upon it. So I guess she could be working the whole time.
Okay, that'd be interesting to see what you could be doing that keeps you so busy that we never ever see her. That would be an interesting thing to see. One thing I wanted to get into and talk a little bit about are the reward levels. They're lots of fun. There's one that nobody has claimed yet, and I'm really surprised. You have a writing class with you.
That's right.
You've got 5 options, and it says attend a live class on Zoom with writer Tom Pinchuk, who has taught script writing courses for years at UCLA Extension.
That's great.
I hope some people dive on and do that, because just talking with you, I can hear your approach to things, I think, would be really good. See, I'm not a writer I write reviews. I can tell you what works and why, but I can't come up with something original. Everything I do is just standard stuff. And I've never been able to do it, and I kind of gave up on all that. But the thing that's interesting for me is, if somebody who has the talent and the ability to do those kinds of things, I think the people could really learn a lot from just our discussion here, brief as it is. There's so many interesting things I think that people who are interested in writing comics could learn and pick up. So I hope that people do that. It's $75 right now as we're talking, and hopefully that'll change. But if there's 5 openings, and there's still 5 openings, unfortunately, but I'd like to see people do that, because I think that it would be fun. I'd like to see what people would write after talking with you. That'd be fun to see.
Well, yeah, it's I really appreciate that. It's it's something that you know, I've studied writing for a long time, and I've tried to view it from every angle, and it was a nice I've been able to teach it at UCLA Extension and also at Comic-Con and the Scriptwriters Network. I'm actually talking with some Russian film school about maybe doing some teaching some seminars for them as well. You know, it's really been a rewarding experience for me, just because I think the more I articulate what works or what doesn't for me, and I always say that I don't really lay out rules. I lay out best practices because, well, it's, you know, you interview sometimes to teach at these places and you have to give an explanation about why you're doing it. And I always think about how, you know, and I think every writer's got a story like this, but my eighth grade English teacher actively tried to dissuade me from writing. And I mean, the short version of it was that she just viewed memoirs as the only valid form of literature. And I was writing science fiction and fantasy back then. And she acted like we had to get her approval to take a creative writing elective in high school. And she just straight up said, "You're not creative," to me. Which even back then I found absurd. And it was something that I have family who are teachers, and they still are just appalled that, anybody would, you know, a teacher would ever say that to a 14-year-old. You know, I had a good comparison of like a good teacher versus a bad teacher, because then when I did take creative writing the next year, his name was Doc Feiberger, and he was, you know, he had the same sort of preference for realistic fiction and nonfiction the way that she did, but he could tell, and he said to me that writing's in your blood. And he wanted to encourage that. He just said that I'd like you to consider that sometimes, you know, an argument at a dinner table can be just as thrilling or feel as apocalyptic as a battle at the end of space, which I thought was a good, you know, I thought that was good advice. And, you know, and I try to, I have students who, you know, I'll teach writing for TV. I've taught for writing for different genres, and they come really from all interests. Some want are stand-ups and they want to develop their stand-up into a story. Some of them are love comic books and science fiction and they want to do that. I had one who was even like, he loved pro wrestling and he wanted to just learn how to do pro wrestling storylines. And you know, I keep an open mind about that, because I think that there's underlying storytelling principles all in there. And I always go back to just, I had a very clear demonstration to me about how you could have one teacher who's very closed-minded about how, you know, what writing options the students have versus one who was more open-minded about it. And so, you know, and I think going back to what you were saying before as well about wanting to learn, really being interested in a subject and wanting to learn more about it and all the ways that it works. The other rewards that we have are, well, they're connected with if you buy a copy of the book, but you'll also get a copy of the script and the artist edition, which was all of Nikos's, just his inks, like all of his line art. And he did it all digitally, but it looks like it's done with pen and ink. And I wanted to learn how to write comics after I got Kurt Busiek and George Perez. There was a their Avengers run. There was a rough cut edition that had the George Perez's pencils and Kurt Busiek's script. And it was fascinating to me to see, well, this is how a comic is done. I think my approach winds up being very detailed. I'll send it to friends and they're kind of really taken aback sometimes about how long the scripts are. But I think it, especially if you're trying to work to a comic to its, to its best strengths, I think it's worthwhile to make it a more complex narrative, to have details that people might not notice right away. So, that's all sort of wrapped up in there, that we tried to make everything available. So if you want to, you know, if you really enjoyed Andy Xenon, you want to see how it came from, you know, soup to nuts, you know, what the whole process was, then we've offered that. It's something, I mean, I personally, like, I always love to find early drafts of screenplays that they might circulate online of films that I enjoyed and sort of compare and contrast. Like, I found you know, an early draft of The Terminator. And I also found like Oliver Stone's absolutely insane first draft of Conan the Barbarian. I'll go on a quick little sidebar about that, but I think that was like pretty funny because I don't think I've ever read a script that, well, what was interesting to me about that was I was intrigued to read it because I really loved that movie. And there was a making of special feature that came with one of the DVD versions of the film. And, you know, Oliver Stone was talking about his first draft and he said that he, you know, his script was really, you know, he was into cloning and genetic mutations and mutants and all that stuff ahead of, you know, years before anybody else was. And he said it in a post-apocalyptic world and he had a replete with all these mutants. And I was like, how the hell did you get paid? Like, I know how these arrangements works. Like if the producer hires you to write a Conan story and you deliver something that's completely different in setting, I don't know how that delivered. And so I was desperate to read that script. And then I found out that he kind of mischaracterized it. It's post-apocalyptic, meaning that there had just been a great flood. It's still in the Hyperborean age. And then also that there are the, you know, I guess at the time he used his mutants as a catch-all term for any sort of like humanoid creature, like an orc. And it's a fascinating script to read though, because I, you know, he's talked about having cocaine problems and I it's hard not to read this and think that he was on cocaine while he's reading it, because like there are no slug lines. Every scene description is a rambling run on sentence, like almost like a beat poetry. And then whenever there's a situation where he might be able to explain a scene in just like a sentence or so, like, you know, Conan stumbles into the throne room and the throne's adorned with jewels. In the script, he'll go on to say, and the throne is adorned with emeralds, amethysts, rubies, sapphires, moonstones. And he just keeps, and you just, like, you're reading this and it just keeps going down. I'm like, okay, I get the point. but yeah, you know, I mean, that's the thing that, look, I mean, I think with all of this, that if I could maybe tie it back to keep it on point, is that, look, I, you know, you talk about inspirations for projects, and I wanted to write the type of book I'd want to read. And if we're putting together a campaign the way Zoop is putting it together, what are the sort of rewards that I would find useful? And I think I'd hope a class might be useful. And then I you know, if you dig the book, I think if it were me, I'd want to know, okay, well, what was the beat? You know, what did the script look like? How did it evolve? Were there any decisions made from the line art to the coloring? We have a really great colorist, Ava De La Cruz, and she really put her stamp on the art. She did phenomenal work. So that's all available there. There's also portfolio reviews by Nikos, and he'll do commissions for backers as well. We also have some variant covers. We've got the cyber edition, which is the digital version of the book. We have the super edition, which is Nikos's cover. We also have the mega edition, which is Brent Schoonover's variant, and then we have the ultra edition, which is the variant cover by Freddie E. Williams II. So all really good, got some good time involved.
Oh yeah, all good stuff. If you go to zoop.gg/c/rememberannyxenon, of course with an X, you get to see all these good things, lots of the covers and things like that, so you can make good choices with there. The way that you're talking about it, you'd like to do more with Andy Xenon. Is there, if this does really well and gets a lot of attention, do you have other stories in mind for Andy Xenon?
You know, I hate to talk about the count chickens before they're hatched. I think maybe what would be more interesting to me would be doing stories about the other characters that we glimpse in his world first. I just sort of love the idea of, you know, we might do maybe more one shots about Base Jump Baz, which is another adventurer that he meets, or Frantastic, and all of them have feet of clay and they're dealing with personal problems that are relatable. Like, you know, at the time of the story, one of them's serving time in jail. The other one has a bad relationship with his family, which it's something that I find it's interesting when you sort of read about, you know, certain like successful people or famous people who have like fractured relationships with family, who are maybe living normal lives, but are happier, even if they're not, hitting certain metrics of success. I actually am, like, Nikos and I are going to be working on we're closing a deal soon, hopefully, that we're going to be doing another, a one shot together. It would be like in a series of one shots for another company. I don't want to say too much about that yet, but okay. I fell back in love with one shots after doing this because, some of the comics that I really liked the most were back in the 90s when Marvel and DC were doing Fifth Week events.
Mm-hmm.
So like Amalgam and Tangent, mm-hmm. and, Marvel's comics or New Year's Evil, that it was kind mm-hmm. of like a la carte anthologies.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And there was just something kind of great about just that kind of poetic focus, because I think, you know, the tough thing with comics, as I observed, is that it's, you know, there's a lot of excitement about your first issue, and then maybe there's a lot of excitement about the last issue, but then it's hard to get people as stoked about issue number 3 or 4, because it's just, you know, it's just purely based off of plot. So that's something there. Maybe there's something to be said about, like, instead of treating it like, say, like songs off of an album, you're having, songs in a concept album, they're more like singles,
mm-hmm.
right? That's what's kind of great about a single, is that you can listen to it on the radio, and it exists in a perfectly formed brevity. But then if you then, like, maybe buy the album and you see it in a fuller context, it takes on a little more meaning, you know, when mm-hmm. you see, like, what the band did in the album, especially if it's like a full out concept album. Mm-hmm. I guess there's less of those these days, but mm-hmm. We're talking about, you'll definitely be seeing more comics from Nikos and I sooner or later. We were also talking about doing a 6-issue miniseries together before this project came together, and part of the reason we didn't pursue it was, like, we were just about to start shopping it around to publishers, and the pandemic happened, and all these editors that we knew got laid off, and there was a major disruption of comics, and so, like, distribution, and so that was also when we connected with Zoop. That was appealing about them was that it's like an even more direct market. You're really going straight to retailers and straight to readers, as opposed mm-hmm. to having a distributor in the middle. And that was something that was just very appealing to me about that model, because mm-hmm. I'd gone through 3 years of that, and I really just wanted to get something in front of an audience and see people interact with the characters that I've created and have an emotional connection to it, it's been kind of great with some people who've read the book so far. That's what you really savor. And when you work in TV, a lot of times you have to defer that for months unto years down the line. Mm-hmm. Or if in a case where you're doing development on a show and there's a merger that you have no control over, and you put all your heart and your blood, sweat, and tears into a project, and now you can't, you know, it's like if a tree falls in the woods, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
No one can see it. No one can interact with it.
Right. I'm just kind of curious, if people want to follow you and keep up with what you're up to, how do they do that on social media?
Well, I'm on Twitter. So it's just my name. It's at Tom Pinchuk, so TOMPINCHUK, which is all one word. I started a newsletter recently that's called the Chuck Chronicles. okay. So that's it's just like CHUK Chronicles, which should be pretty easy to find. I kind of prefer that because I just had the hardest time trying to boil down what I'm thinking into however many characters in these sound bites. And what I like about the newsletter is I can go into deeper detail and make them more substantial. And we also have a mail column there that I'm using for fan mail. And, you know, I'd say I updated it. I've only done about 2 installments so far, but the response has been great. And I'll probably be updating it maybe like every 2-3 weeks or so.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's something that you'll see updates about my projects. There's also some stuff about like what I'm reading, or, you know, some friends' work. I have some writing tips, which is a little like snippets from some of my classes. Mm-hmm. And then I'll also, you know, I just talk a little bit about what's going on in my career. Like, you know, recently there was a show that I worked on a couple years ago that I didn't realize was on Netflix. And it was sort of news to me, because that's sort of how TV works, is that once you've written a script, there's not really any dedicated staffer who's there to keep you up to date. So you sort of have to be your own cataloger. So, you know, I talked about that on a newsletter recently. So, you know, and the thing is, like, I'll promote stuff on my Twitter feed as well. And typically, like, that's where I'll put my, you know, if I have a new newsletter out, I'll announce it there as well. It's just, I found like kind of email through that site is going to be better for communication, just because I don't know. I tried the Twitter thing and I could just never make it work. I just can't. It's just, it's so constricting for me.
Yeah, they canceled my account for some reason on Twitter, and so I had to restart it. And I'm kind of like, I don't know, because, you know, they always say a tweet lasts on a thing for about 8 seconds, and then it's gone. So yeah. I struggle with Twitter. Should I really be doing this? You know. So anyway, that's good. But anyway, that's good that we can check that.
That's another part of it too. Is that like I would talk to people about, you know, doing Twitter right, and it's like you kind of have to be on there all day.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Tweeting and retweeting, and I'm like, I'm trying to get scripts done. It's not really great to be like dividing my attention. I'm not going to get anything done. I think people would rather see some great comics from me than, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. That's true. Well, let me one more time say that the place to get it is to get these is Zoop, Z-O-O-P as in Paul, .gg/C as in Charlie / Remember Andy Xenon. That's Xenon starts with an X, not a Z. So yeah. Now, one last thing I thought I would mention. There's a praise section on the there. And one of my favorite artist writers, or writer artist, depending on how you do it, he made some comment about you that I thought was worth mentioning. Phil Hester, who Green Arrow, Wonder Woman, many other good things. He says, "Don't ask me which book is going to be the new hotness. Ask me where Tom Pinchuk is right now." And I thought that was a nice thing to say, and I think accurate too, because I'm going to be buying your stuff wherever I see it. If I see your name someplace, I'm going to be sure to pick it up.
Well, yeah, I appreciate that, Wayne. Yeah, Phil's a really great guy, and I was lucky that he gave us that endorsement. You know, we've got. You know, I loved his work, like The Coffin, and you know, he did a book with Mike Cuddleston with the Deep Sleeper, which I really enjoyed. And I think it's great when you have a creator whose work you admire vibes with what you're doing. And you know, we were kind of taking the book out and getting some feedback from some people. So we've also got some quotes from Kieran Gillen and Tim Seeley and Jeffrey Thorne and J.M. DeMatteis, and also Julia Leewald, who worked on X-Men, the animated series. And it was just very, you know, humbling and just really validating to see these were all creators whose work I deeply admired. And they got the book and they liked it a lot.
One last question. Do you know when this book's going to be available, when it's going to be mailed out?
I'd say probably the fall. You know, that's something that Zoop kind of handles, but I think that they've got about, once the campaign ends, they're talking about probably like 2 to 3 months turnover. What's kind of great about working with Zoop is that, you know, they let me just kind of work on making the best comics that I can, and I get to do, go out there and talk about the book like this, and I don't have to really do as many of the logistical stuff, you know, so... Like, for instance, they have their printers that they're working with and the delivery. So that's, I'd say probably by the fall. But that's not, that's my best. I think that's my educated guess. I don't know the exact date yet.
Well, whenever it gets here, I'm looking forward to reading it. So thanks, Tom. It was great to talk with you. And I'm going to be sure to keep track of what you're up to. And maybe we can talk some more in the future when you get another project coming down the pike.
I'd love that. Thanks so much for having me, and I'm glad you you know, you're digging the book, and I should hopefully have, if all goes well, you'll be seeing more of me in comics pretty soon. So stay tuned.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
And that's it for this episode. Be back next time. I'll have another great interview with an excellent comics creator, something I'm sure you won't want to miss. But until then, keep reading your comics.